You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
The question of how the United States wound up in Vietnam remains a complex and controversial one, but the origins of the conflict go much further back than you might imagine. In his book, Embers of War, The Fall of an Empire and the Making of America's Vietnam, Frank Logavall, a professor of history at Cornell, examines how and why the struggle for Vietnam occupies such a central role in the story of 20th century conflicts. It's published by Random House, and I'm very pleased to welcome Professor Logavall back to our show today. Hello.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Why is there still controversy among historians as to the exact start of the Vietnam War for the United States?
Well, I think that one
can't... Not the Gulf of Tonkin?
Not the Gulf of Tonkin. And the president, as you may know, in May, President Obama said that this is the 50th anniversary of the Vietnam War's beginning. So the administration has decided that 1962 is when it started. I think most historians now would say that the war really began in 1959 or 60. That is when the United States had made a commitment to build up and defend South Vietnam. And that is when the North Vietnamese basically decided that they would have to win in the South, probably by military means. And of course, as I suggest in the book, one could go further back. I argue that in order to understand the Second Indochina War, we have to grasp and we have to deal with the French War.
Well, had the French already left in 59?
They had. They were defeated in that climactic battle that we all know about, at Dien Bien Phu in 1954, and the last French troops were out about 1956.
How long had the French held Vietnam, or Indochina, as they called it, as a colony, and how did they wind up there?
Well, they had held it for... it began really in the middle of the 19th century, and certainly they had completed the process of the takeover by the late 1880s, I think it's fair to say. And it was a combination of geostrategic rationale, that the British in particular are landing in this part of the world and we need to keep up with them. There was an economic motivation. There was a sense of a missionary impulse. French missionaries had been there actually for a couple of hundred years. They too suggested we have something we need to do here in Indochina.
So the British had China and they had Indochina to some degree. Now, Ho Chi Minh was born not long after the French really consolidated their control. He was born in 1890. Yeah. Was he political from the start?
From a very early point, I think it's clear that he was political and became increasingly anti-French as a young man, as a teenager. And then, of course, embarked on a set of travels that would take him really around the world, including for a spell in the United States.
And New York and Boston.
New York and Boston. And then settled after World War II, after World War I, settled in Paris. And then, and I begin the book with his attempt to meet with Woodrow Wilson and other Allied leaders at Versailles. This was a failed attempt. He rented a top coat for the occasion so that he could be seen. And there's maybe the first what if in the story. What if he had been able to have an audience with them?
Was he influenced by his travels? By what he saw?
I think he was. I think he had, interestingly enough, this is a kind of theme in the book, I think it's fair to say. He had an admiration for the United States that probably predated his visit, but I'm guessing was also reinforced by that visit to the United States. And I think more generally, he was in many ways a quite cosmopolitan figure, and that's at least in part because of these travels.
But wasn't he also shocked by the racial inequality he saw in the United States?
Yeah, I think it was a real study in contrast for him. I think that what he saw in Harlem, what he saw to some extent in Boston, I think had that kind of effect on him.
And sure, there was also discrimination against Chinese in this country.
Sure.
We had immigration laws that barred the Chinese from coming
which
here.
Which he saw up close. And at the same time, the message of the United States, and in particular the anti-colonial message, I think was very important to him.
So he was inspired by the Declaration of Independence, also by the French culture's ideas, liberté, égalité, fraternité. But he saw us as being hypocrites?
I think so, and certainly with the passage of time, he came to see this more and more. But it's still striking to me that as late as 1948 and 49, which is quite far into the war against France, that late he still held out hope that the United States can be my ally in my quest for independence. This was a belief that he was very reluctant, I think, to give up.
So he was more moderate than one might assume for a communist leader. Did we kind of drive him by rejecting him into Stalin's and Mao's arms?
Well, it may be too much to say that the United States drove him into Stalin's arms. And I don't want to romanticize Ho Chi Minh. I think that in many ways he and his colleagues could be tremendously ruthless. They certainly made their made their share of mistakes, as I suggest in the book. But I think in many ways he was a pragmatist, and he was willing to work with the French. He was willing to settle short of independence and try to reassure Americans that if Vietnam becomes communist, it won't be for a very long time.
Well, earlier, as you say, he tried. He admired Woodrow Wilson's ideas after World War I. But I guess there was also an assumption that that France would let Vietnam go at that point.
Yes, or certainly a hope that the French would come to realize that colonialism was not in keeping with the times. That both in Indochina and elsewhere, the European powers were going to have to let this thing go.
We think of him as a communist leader, but haven't some historians argued that many of his ideas were more Confucian than Marx-Lenin?
Oh, I think that's quite right, and I would be among them. I do think he was a dedicated communist. I think he saw communism as the best path of development for his country. But he was also a nationalist. I don't think there's a contradiction between the two. And as you say, had been imbued with, had taken these Confucian ideas on which he was raised, and they were always with him.
What he had met with Stalin at some point, hadn't he?
Whether the two of them actually met face-to-face before, in the interwar period, I'm not clear about. They did meet when he was seeking Soviet assistance, when he needed both Chinese assistance and Soviet assistance as the war was ramping up. I think their meeting took place in 1950.
Mm-hmm. Did they get along?
Stalin was quite dismissive. He said, "You Orientals have such rich imaginations." But Stalin also supplied a certain degree of assistance. He basically let the communist Chinese under Mao take the lead in supporting Ho's forces. But diplomatic support, some political support, certainly came Ho's way.
Now, at one point, Ho even wrote a play called Le Dragon de Bambou. So he wrote it in French?
Yes, The Bamboo Dragon, yes.
And was this play a hit?
As far as I can tell, it closed after just a few performances. So I would say maybe his talents were elsewhere, shall we say.
And do you think that led him to make more of a commitment to becoming a political figure? I've mm-hmm. always wondered how one person rises mm-hmm. to become a political figure when there are so many people who are probably vying for the job.
That's an interesting question. And you know, suppose this had been a big hit, would he have mm-hmm. gone in a very different direction? Possibly. I think he was already increasingly political. He was already certainly an agitator for Vietnamese independence even before writing this play. But who knows? I mean, one of the interesting things about him is that he was a kind of Francophile anti-colonialist, in the sense that I think he was very devoted to French culture, to the French language. He was upset when the French started using English language, English words, for example. He did not like franglais, and he said so on several occasions. So he had this kind of conflicted view of the French nation and the French culture.
Well, Vietnam continued to have be influenced by the French.
Course.
Its food, for example.
Of course.
Other things. So there was this colonial legacy, whether people rejected
exactly
the colonial
right.
power or not. My guest is Frederick Lokval. He is the John S. Knight Professor of International Studies and Professor of History at Cornell University, where he serves as Director of the Mario Einaudi Center for International Studies. His latest book, Embers of War, The Fall of an Empire and the Making of America's Vietnam, published by Random House. How did the German takeover of France during World War II change thinking about the future in many of the French colonies, especially in Indochina?
Well, I think that for the French, and the French under Vichy, It became more important even after they had been defeated by after France had been defeated by Germany. It became all the more important to hang on to the empire, so that Vichy authorities became passionately devoted to affirming their control of Indochina. For the Indochinese and for the Vietnamese, I think this was a sign that fundamentally this French power was a bit of a shell, that in fact France was far less powerful than they had thought. They were defeated in 6 weeks by the Germans. There's an opportunity here for us to reclaim independence.
And then the Japanese took over the area.
Yes.
How were they received by the Vietnamese? After all, the Japanese declared themselves as the opponents of European colonialism.
Well, initially, I think there were a lot of Vietnamese who were prepared to give the Japanese the benefit of the doubt. They thought maybe this will be a path for independence and the Japanese will respect us as a Vietnamese nation. I think very soon it became clear to the Vietnamese, including to Ho and other nationalists, that they were no better off really under Japanese control than they had been under the French.
So did they fight the Japanese?
They did. And as fortunes turned sour for the Japanese, especially in 44 and 45, Ho Chi Minh and the Viet Minh were in a way uniquely positioned, or at least took better advantage than non-communist nationalists, in combating the Japanese, putting themselves in a position to claim power once the Japanese had been defeated.
And the United States was supporting the Viet Minh in that struggle against the Japanese.
Yeah, I mean, this is a fascinating part of the story that I detail in the book, the degree to which they were really side by side. American operatives in Indochina and the Viet Minh in the jungles of Tonkin in northern Vietnam really were working together. This was one of the reasons why Ho Chi Minh believed in August of 1945, which I call a kind of open moment in the story. He believed the Americans are going to be with me as I proclaim Vietnamese independence.
This is a theme we've seen throughout the 20th century, the blowback.
Oh, yeah.
We support an insurrection, as we did in Afghanistan.
Yeah.
And then afterward, we change sides and we pay a price.
Yeah.
We decided to throw in our lot with the French, even though there was a strong anti-colonial feeling throughout the world at this point.
Yeah, and I think that Franklin Roosevelt, as you know, during the war, I think had been sincerely and passionately anti-colonial. FDR was determined to try to keep the French from reclaiming control.
He didn't exactly love Charles de Gaulle either, did he?
He didn't love de Gaulle, and that was maybe part of it. But I think an interesting what-if, which I speculate a little bit about in my conclusion, suppose FDR had lived beyond August of 1945, it's not fanciful to believe that he would have worked to prevent a French return and thereby would have changed the course of history.
But do you think that de Gaulle was aware of the contradiction of reasserting control mm-hmm. over Vietnam? He had fought to free France from occupation, but then he believed that his country's colonial possessions should remain under French control, not just Indochina, of course, but also the French colonies in North Africa.
Sure. It's an excellent point, and it's fascinating to me that de Gaulle, for all of his wisdom, all of his sagacity, could not perceive what you've just articulated. That is to say that other people might have the same commitment to independence and to freeing oneself from occupation that he had. He had been so skillful and so devoted to this for metropolitan France, he could never quite grasp until 1953-54, when he's out of power, that the Vietnamese might have that same determination that he had.
My guest is Frederick Loggeval, L-O-G-E-V-A-L-L. His latest book, Embers of War, The Fall of an Empire and the Making of America's Vietnam, published by Random House. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We are back with Frederick Loggeval, who is the John S. Knight Professor of International Studies and Professor of History at Cornell University, where he serves as the director of the Mario Arnaudi Center for International Studies. His book, Embers of War, The Fall of an Empire and the Making of America's Vietnam, published by Random House. So why did the United States decide to throw in its lot with the the Chinese, I mean, with the French rather than with the Vietnamese? Was it simply a matter of the domino theory already being posited?
I think that was certainly part of the rationale. There was a belief, especially after Mao's forces won their victory in China in 1949, that you had to prevent further expansion of communism in Southeast Asia. This was the place to do it with the French. But even before Mao's victory, the United States had tacitly, at least, agreed to back the French. And that also had to do with European concerns, with a belief that you had to have a strong France in the center of Europe. And the way to do that was to support the French in their imperial designs.
Well, you're right that the French Indochina War sat at the intersection of the grand political forces that drove world affairs during the 20th century.
Yeah.
Vietnam, not Cambodia, Laos, or any other country, because this was seen as the place where we drew the line in the sand?
Yeah, and I think what I'm suggesting there is that you've got, because that French Indochina War really began at the century's midpoint, you've got, on the one hand, the transformative effects of World War II. You've got the rise of the United States to supreme power in world affairs, especially in the Pacific. You've got the start of the Cold War and the expansion of the Cold War. And you've also got, at the same time, in Indochina, the confrontation between European imperialism and anti-colonial nationalism in a way that you would see elsewhere, but I think happened in some ways first and most powerfully in Indochina.
Well, isn't it difficult to reassert your control over a country after you've lost your control of it?
Yeah.
How did the French begin to reinsert themselves after the war?
Well, I think there was a remarkable degree of unanimity on the part of French political opinion, including the Communist Party, that the empire was critical to France reclaiming its grandeur on the world stage. The country had been humiliated in 1940, and if France was once again to be a great power, it needed to have the empire. So there was that motivation, and they were able to do it in part because of support from the great powers. The British were critical in allowing the French to come back in and, in fact, supporting the French effort. I talk about this in the book. Tacit support from the United States. Again, I think FDR's passing matters. Truman just didn't have the same kind of interest in Indochina.
And the French were better equipped, which, of course, was the same mistake the United States made later. Were many of the guerrilla tactics that we used against the Americans later already being employed in the Viet Minh's conflict with the French?
Oh, yeah. It's remarkable the degree to which there were these parallels on the military side. And so many of the problems that the Americans encountered and thought were in some way new to them, the French had already seen.
And they didn't, and nobody went back and looked at them, talked to the French about how they had to deal with it?
Very little. I think there was a sense, or at least a hope, that we are not the French, and what the French experienced, we will not experience. We're militarily superior. We have a better message. We are, in fact, there for the right reasons. We won't encounter the same problems.
When I think of Vietnam at this time, Graham Greene's name comes to mind because of his book, The Quiet American. How long was he there?
He wintered. He spent part of four winters in Vietnam, mostly in Saigon and Hanoi. Saigon was kind of his base of operations.
Did the French control all the country at this point, or had they already lost parts of the north?
Well, he was there for the first time really in an extended sense in 1951. And already the Viet Minh are established in the northern part of the country in Tonkin and also in the extreme south. The French have still control most of the urban areas of the country, but he's seeing the war up close. He comes upon the idea of writing this novel, and my book deals with how he comes to do this. And you know, it's remarkable the degree to which so many Americans know of the French War through this novel, The Quiet American.
Did he meet this American named Leo Hockstetter, who he based his character Alden Pyle on? How close are the two?
Well, it's really hard to know. Some have speculated that Edward Lansdale is really the model for Alden Pyle. I suggest in the book that this is not the case. He didn't know of Lansdale, didn't meet Lansdale until after he had begun writing the novel. I think Hockstetter is at least to some extent a model for the Pyle figure. And he met both Americans and Frenchmen while he was there, and much of what he experienced does figure in the novel.
Well, Colonel Edward Lansdale was given the job of propping up Diem on behalf of the United States. Why was he selected?
Well, he had had significant experience, especially in the Philippines. He was perceived as somebody who understood insurgencies, who could combat effectively communist revolutionary forces, and was basically instructed, in so many words, by the Dulles brothers to go out and do in South Vietnam what you were able to do in the Philippines.
Where he is said to have invented Philippine President Ramon Magsaysay. But the Neil Sheehan has said that South Vietnam was a creation of Edward Lansdale. Do you think that's true?
Well, it's an exaggeration by Neil Sheehan, but it also has, and I think he knows that, but it has more than a grain of truth. I do think that Lansdale was critically important in those years after the French were defeated in 1954. Diem is appointed that same year. And from a very early point, Lansdale is a key Diem advisor, plays a large role on any number of issues pertaining to South Vietnamese politics, to dealing with this emerging insurgency. I think Lansdale is an important figure and a fascinating one.
Now, what about the domino theory? Was that ever really a viable idea? It was so popular.
I think it was in many ways an odd theory from the beginning, in the sense that it didn't allow for the individuality of conditions, for the idea that revolutions depend on what is going on in that particular country, not what's going on elsewhere. Having said that, there was a plausibility to the theory, especially early on. Once Mao wins in China, you have instantly doubled the number of major communist foes. It was not completely fanciful to believe that Mao would now seek to spread Chinese and communist control, that the Soviets were in cahoots with him, and that you could have some version of this domino theory being realized.
My guest is Frederick Lugeval. His book, Embers of War, The Fall of an Empire and the Making of America's Vietnam, published by Random House. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Well, also, there was American politics to consider in all of this. Cold War politics. McCarthyism was playing itself out in Washington during the time. And then Richard Nixon. How large a role did he play in shaping President Eisenhower's views on Vietnam?
I think that Nixon was influential in the administration. But I also believe that Dwight Eisenhower was more hawkish on Indochina, more hawkish on with respect to what to do in Vietnam than many historians have suggested.
Because he ended the war in Korea, one would assume that he really didn't want the United States to get involved with wars.
This is true. And I'm not suggesting that he relished the idea of a military intervention in Vietnam, but I think Eisenhower, quite independent of Richard Nixon's advocacy, though it mattered, Dwight Eisenhower came closer to intervening to support, to bail out the French, if you will, at Dien Bien Phu in the spring of 1954 than many have suggested. He was prepared to do so under certain conditions.
Now, did U.S. military and political leaders see the French forces as weak or somehow unable to put up a decent fight?
Oh, I think there was a low opinion on the part of a great many military officials and civilian diplomatic officials in Washington and in Saigon, a low opinion of what the French were doing militarily. I argue in the book that the French expeditionary forces actually fought quite well in most engagements. Like the Americans later, they won far more engagements than they lost. They understood the enemy. They adapted to that enemy. They didn't have enough forces. The French were not going to send conscripts to Indochina. They relied on legionnaires.
They were also fighting wars in Africa, and especially in North Africa.
Yeah, the Algerian War really begins after they leave, or at least begin to leave Indochina. But yes, they have other pressing manpower needs, also in Europe itself. But Americans never, I think, fully appreciated the degree to which, as I said earlier, the problems that the French encountered on the ground, they too would experience.
Were American policymakers already suggesting that we needed to intervene in Vietnam to do more than just offer some help to the French?
Well, I think that only in the spring of 1954, when things reach ahead, do you have serious discussion in Washington about intervening either with just air power or perhaps even with ground troops. But then I think it becomes a very live issue, as I suggest in the book.
Well, in 1954, we have the Geneva Conference, which mm-hmm. divides Vietnam along the seventh parallel.
Right.
And it called for a national election in 1956. I guess some people thought that that would lead to a lasting peace.
Yeah, I think if one talks about missed opportunities, I think one has to think of 1956 from an American perspective as a missed opportunity. Dwight Eisenhower, it seems to me, not just in hindsight, but in the context of the time, Dwight Eisenhower would have been much better off to support an election, which after all, as you say, had been called for in Geneva, and make a stand elsewhere in the region, in, say, Thailand, which was much more suited to a kind of defensive posture. That was something that the administration refused to do, needless to say.
Well, because if there were a plebiscite, it was assumed that Ho Chi Minh would have won.
Yes, and as you said just that earlier, American domestic politics, I think, is important here. It's especially important for Democrats and, of course, will be crucial for Kennedy and Johnson later on. I think even for Dwight Eisenhower and for Republicans. Yeah. The idea of giving up, even through an election, giving up a piece of territory to communists was anathema.
Was the government that Ho Chi Minh set up in North Vietnam mm-hmm. just a pure communist government?
It was a communist government. I think there's no question about that. I think during the war against the French, the Viet Minh included non-communist elements. I think in 1954, when that government took formal power, if you will, in Hanoi, it was certainly communist-led, communist-dominated.
And then there was some retaliation of people who were opposed to the communists.
Oh, there's no question. There was, as I said earlier, this was a ruthless government in many respects. We should not suggest otherwise. And a great many people suffered, especially in North Vietnam after this takeover.
And then in South Vietnam, a man who had lived in Lakewood, New Jersey, became a major political figure.
He sure did. Ngo Dinh Diem took power in mid-1954, and it was the figure on which Americans pinned their hopes and became the leader of South Vietnam for the next 9 years.
Now, he was a Catholic, and how important is the fact that there were many Catholics in Vietnam to American policy? I remember Cardinal Spellman giving his blessing to the troops because he said they were going off to a holy war.
I think it mattered. I'm not sure how much it mattered. I think that when the United States in 1954 agreed to throw its weight behind Diem, I'm not sure it was crucial that Diem was a Catholic per se. I think it gained more importance over time when Diem came to the United States in 1957. On a highly successful visit, ticker tape parade here in New York City, a speech to a joint session of Congress, lots of media appearances. It was a very successful visit. Then I think the fact that he was Catholic mattered a great deal in terms of selling him, if you will, to the American people.
Was he the best potential leader?
I think in many ways, actually, he was, which says something about the paucity, the shortage of able leaders in South Vietnam after the split.
But we allowed him to be overthrown in a coup. In fact, to some degree, we engineered the coup, didn't we?
We did, and I should also make clear that he had very real shortcomings that became more and more clear over time. He was repressive. He was politically myopic. He seemed to have an inability to delegate authority, beyond a tight inner circle. But he was the one South Vietnamese of note who had a genuine sort of vision for the future of his country. He was a dedicated nationalist. He was personally courageous. So there's a reason why he became the leader and why he lasted as long as he did. Over time, however, these shortcomings became more and more pronounced, if you will.
You're right that in practice, American modernizers tended to be distrustful of populist politics and inclined to favor elite-led societies. Often they turned to modernization as a means of counterintelligence and social control. Has this been the case in many of our military ventures since Vietnam, or did we learn a lesson in Vietnam?
I think it has been, regrettably, a tendency well beyond Vietnam. A tendency, as you say, when push comes to shove, to support elites in leadership positions, and to subordinate the degree to which we need to have democratic enlargement, the degree to which we need to have broad popular support for the government in question. I think one sees that in Afghanistan today, for example.
Well, but in Vietnam, the CIA, which had already engineered a number of coups around the world, mm-hmm. just seemed to think that if they engineered another coup, everything was going to be okay. But the people who they brought to power all seemed to be worse and worse.
Well, this is true. I would add to what you've just said that the CIA was, from an early point, quite skeptical about the prospects in Vietnam. Saw, even under Diem, even early on in the Diem years, that he was unlikely to win broad popular support of the type that could really compete with Ho Chi Minh in the north. And so maybe it's more fair to say that the CIA, in helping to engineer the coup, hoped that his successors would be better able to mount this kind of a challenge.
Now, you don't really deal with this in this book, do you? But there's been a lot of debate over whether if JFK had lived, mm-hmm. we would have wound up in Vietnam.
That's something I deal more with in my first book, Choosing mm-hmm. War, which looks closely at the Americanization of the war in 1964 and 65. And in that one, I have a section in my conclusion called If Oswald Had Missed. So it's a section that considers this issue closely. My view, and of course we can never know, my view is that a surviving Kennedy would have avoided a large-scale escalation of the war. He was a different kind of leader than LBJ. He relied on a broader range of opinion. He also did not have the domestic political pressure, because he would have made that decision in his second and final term. I think we would have had something other than an Americanized war.
Well, he kept us out of war with the Soviet Union and Cuba during the missile crisis, where LBJ was pretty much a major advocate for going to war.
Exactly. And I opened this new book, Embers of War, with Kennedy's quite fascinating visit to Indochina in 1951 as a congressman. And we see, even in 1951, John F. Kennedy asking very large questions about what Western powers can do militarily in that part of the world. He was, in some ways, always, I think, a skeptic on Indochina, even as he himself helped to escalate the conflict.
Frederick Logeval, L-O-G-E-V-A-L-L, his book, Embers of War, The Fall of an Empire and the Making of America's Vietnam, published by Random House. Thank you so much for being with us again.
It's been good to be here.